Small towns are interesting. In a way, they make up most of our nation. A 2019 study found that there are 16,410 cities in the U.S. that have a population of less than 10,000, while there are only 10 cities that have populations over 1 million. Maybe this is why we romanticize the idea of small-town America. We've adopted this idea that for some reason, small towns are immune to the wickedness, misfortune, and vice of major metropolitan areas. Despite our belief, however, small towns aren't immune from bad luck. Their newspapers just have less readers. My name is Josh, and you're listening to Obscure History. Throughout its history, Roseburg, Oregon has personified small-town America. However, long before high school football games, sweltering nights at the county fair, and starlit drives through the timber, the ground below and around Roseburg was a diverse melting pot. Native tribes speaking languages like Siuslaw, Yonkala, Upper Umpqua, and Molalla thrived and enjoyed a great abundance of deer, elk, salmon, huckleberries, and hazelnuts. The land was emerald with tall pines split only by the rushing of many fervent rivers and creeks. It was in this land that on Halloween Day, 1855, the Umpqua people valiantly defended their way of life from American soldiers in the Battle of Hungry Hill and the Rogue River Wars. This land today is named after the Umpqua, though they were forced out of it by disease and battle and broken promises. You see, long before there was Roseburg, there was Umpqua. The land of thundering water. In 1851, a New Yorker turned Michigan land developer turned Oregon pioneer Aaron Rose built the first structure in what is today Roseburg. He assembled a small clapboard shack which he used as a grocery store, kitchen, and shabby makeshift inn. Rose used this structure to accommodate travelers, trappers, pioneers, and settlers for years. It is said that Uncle Aaron, as he was called, always had bountiful provisions for those in need, so long as they had the proper amount of gold dust to exchange. After the permanent establishment of Rose's roadside store, people began to settle around him. By 1852, the Deer Creek Post Office was established, and by 1857, the settlers began officially identifying the fledgling town as Roseburg. The settlement was officially incorporated in 1872. As the Umpqua did before them, the European settlers began to thrive. The land was abundant in resources. As the number of settlers grew, so too did the need for lumber. The demand for new buildings grew and grew until Roseburg became known as the timber capital of the nation. In 1937, Roseburg Lumber was founded by Kenneth Ford, and the wealth generated by this explosion of industry was so substantial that Kenneth Ford's fortune lives on through the Ford Family Foundation, which continues to provide funding for important community development projects and scholarships in Douglas County today. In fact, by the 1960s, Roseburg was so well known for its lumber industry that the man in black, Johnny Cash, wrote a song about it.
Ride this train to Roseburg, Oregon. Now there's a town for you, and you talk about rough. You know, a lot of places in the country claim Paul Bunyan lived there, but you should have seen Roseburg when me and my daddy come there. Every one of them loggers looked like Paul Bunyan to me. But I was a skinny kid about 16, and I was scared to death when we walked into that camp. None of the lumberjacks paid any attention to me at first, but my pa told the boss that me and him wanted a job. A lot of them stopped their work just to see what was going to happen. That big boss walked around me, looked me up and down, and said, "Mister, I believe that boy is made out of second growth timber." And I guess I was. Everybody but me and pa had a big laugh over it. Pa got kind of mad. Boss finally said he might start me out as a high climber. I didn't know what a high climber was. Boy, I sure learned fast. That steel-corded rope cut my back, and that axe, I thought it was going to break my arms off. But I stuck with it, and it wasn't long till I learned that a man's got to be a lot tougher than the timber he's cutting. Finally, I could swing that crosscut.
For a time, things were going great for the residents of Roseburg. However, good times are not often built to last. But before we continue, we need to pause for about 1 minute to hear from some sponsors. On August 7th, 1959, George Rutherford parked his truck next to Gerritsen's building supply and left it for the night. This, by itself, is not strange. However, in the back of Rutherford's truck sat 6.5 tons of explosives. And as the townsfolk all turned in for bed, the truck sat there, unattended, illuminated only by the light of the moon and stars. What happened that night has permanently scarred the memory and the landscape of Roseburg. At 1 a.m., Gerritsen's building supply caught fire. Firefighters rushed to the scene to save the structure and anyone who might be inside. They did everything they could to push the flames back and to search for anyone that might be in danger. Their full focus was on the blaze. In fact, they were so focused on the blaze that they didn't see the truck parked next to the building. And even if they had, they might not have stopped to realize what was inside the truck. At 1:14 in the morning, the flames grew from Gerritsen's building supply and reached out just far enough to ignite the explosives inside George Rutherford's truck. And, in one brilliant instant, eight city blocks were gone. The firefighters who were dutifully serving their community disappeared in a flash of heat and energy. 14 people lost their lives in the blast, and another 125 were injured. Witnesses say that when word of the fire reached George Rutherford, he attempted to run towards it. The force of the blast blew him backward into the street. When he tried to get up and run toward the fire, he told those who were giving him medical attention that he needed to see how many people he had killed. For reference, the explosion that I played was a one-ton TNT explosion. The Roseburg blast was 6 times that magnitude. The blast was so large that a commercial jet passing overhead called the airport in nearby Medford, Oregon, to report that a nuclear attack may have hit Roseburg. And while it might be easy for us to look back and scoff at the idea of the Russians targeting little old Roseburg, things are not so clear and easily definable in a crisis. And the Cold War was very much on the minds of Americans in 1959. The same children that had to learn nuclear attack drills at school were suddenly startled awake by an unimaginably loud explosion and a fiery mushroom in the sky above their once quiet town. What followed was pure mayhem.
About a fire at Gerritsen's. We'd been there probably 5-10 minutes or something, and I was helping McFarlane get hooked up to the fire hydrant. Somebody, I don't know who, to this day, I don't know who it was, come running down through there and said, there's a dynamite truck up there and it's on fire. And my car was right out in the middle of the street, say roughly 50 yards from the truck. Run around there to get in the car and everything went kaboom and it knocked me down in the seat and slammed the door against my leg and it just put the impression of my leg right in that door. The car was out in the street and it blew it backwards, I would say a good 30 feet. I was just full of glass in the windshield or someplace. As I looked up, all I could see was this great big fireball, big chunks of concrete and everything going there. Car was on fire, light wires and stuff all around it. And I was a little bit afraid to get out, but I had to because it was getting hot in there. And so I worked my way out through there and got on up to the intersection. And people were just going nuts.
That was the voice of Sam Gosso in an interview he did for Land of Umpqua on YouTube. If you want to look further into this disaster after you're done listening to this episode, then please feel free to head over to their channel. The videos that they put together are very good, and they feature a ton of historic photos. In the days following the blast, the National Guard was called in to help control the situation and prevent looting. And as the cleanup crews started fully assessing the damages, the future looked bleak. 8 city blocks had basically been leveled by the initial blast, but windows were broken and doors blown off their hinges in buildings up to 9 miles away from the blast site. The library had so much broken glass that even after reopening, the librarians had to check each book for glass shrapnel before they could be checked out. It is estimated that the blast caused around $10 million in damages. If we adjust that for inflation, the total damages nearly reach $100 million in today's money. The news of the blast traveled far and fast.
Devastated as though by Blitz air raid is the business center of Roseburg, Oregon. It happened one night. Soon after 1 a.m. came the explosion that terrified the town's 12,000 people. 12 were killed, more than 100 injured. Daylight revealed the appalling damage, estimated at $12 million. The cause of it all was amazing. A truck with 6.5 tons of explosives had parked for the night. Nearby premises caught fire and the blaze spread to the truck. 35 buildings were razed to the ground. Damage extended over 22 blocks.
The community came together to clean and rebuild Roseburg. However, the city was denied federal emergency relief funding. Luckily, 98% of the businesses that were within the blast radius were properly insured and were able to begin rebuilding quickly. In a way, the Roseburg blast shows us one of the biggest fantasies about small-town America. The city of Roseburg was denied federal funding to rebuild at basically every turn. There were many plans to rebuild the city. Some fantastical, others futuristic, but because of a lack of funding, most of the work was done with insurance claims and private funds. You see, one of the biggest appeals that people have for the small-town life is the idea that if I can't get help when I'm supposed to, somebody will come around and we'll help each other. It's a sense of community that you expect to find in small-town America instead of New York City or Los Angeles. Certainly, that's not really true. It's just the stereotype. Sometimes when you need help in small-town America, you end up with the Texas Chainsaw Massacre or The Hills Have Eyes. I mean, you're always hoping to get Little House on the Prairie, but you never know. Today, Roseburg's population is double what it was that August 9, 1959. The city did rebuild and modernize. The response to the blast really shows us the best of what we can be. People jumped in to complete madness to help out their neighbor. They rebuilt themselves when the federal government couldn't give them emergency funds, and they persevered through an insanely difficult time. Much like other small towns across the nation, Roseburg has thrived, been beset by tragedy, only to rebuild and then be damaged again. Life gives us the sweetest moments, but it also takes what we most love, and it leaves us burnt and leveled. And there is no shield from that experience, whether you live in Los Angeles, California, or Rogersville, Tennessee. All right, guys, thank you so much for listening. I hope that you enjoyed the, like, quote-unquote new show. It's just a little bit different, nothing too crazy, right? I mean, still me, still history that you should know about, but don't. And yeah, just a little bit wider variety, and I'm taking my writing just a slight bit more serious. I mean, you know, got to use that education and all. So if you liked this episode, follow Obscure History Pod on Instagram or email obscurehistorypod@gmail.com to get in touch with me. There should be like a share button in your podcast player. I use Spotify. I know that literally none of you do because it tells me those kinds of things, like what you listen to my show on and things like that. But I'm sure that within Apple Podcasts, there's like a button you can use to like share the episode, tag me in it. Even though I like rebranded, quote unquote, it's still me, and I am still not making enough money to hire a social media person for myself. So I will 100% see anything you tag me in. Also, rate it and review it on iTunes. Enough of you listen that if we all rated and reviewed this morning, I'm sure that we could bump back into the history charts here in the US, and I think that would be awesome. So, there's a bunch of other stuff that I'm always supposed to say that I can't ever remember. One of my goals for this is to, like, literally get this show big enough that I can hire an assistant.
That is like my biggest life goal, because you know what I don't like to do really? Social media. And you know what I also am really bad at? Remembering all the business things I'm supposed to say. Because I'm sure there are other things that could help this show that I'm supposed to say, like supposed to ask you to do, but like I never remember. It's so frustrating. I'm like the worst at this. Okay, so I'm beyond excited to share the indie music feature this time. Today we've got Little Axe by A People Person. This is the musical project of streamer and podcaster Sydney Emanuel. You can find Sydney on Twitch at Sydney Gale or playing characters on some of the shows in the Glass Cannon Network. She's crazy talented at all of the things, and I really hope that you enjoy this song and go check out her album. It is honestly, and I mean this honestly because I listen to a lot of new music. I like am one of those obnoxious people that's always on the hunt for something like new and obscure to listen to. But honestly, this album is one of my favorites that I've picked up in a good long while. It might be my favorite since Phoebe Bridgers' Punisher. And that's saying a lot because that album is a masterpiece. So, okay, here it is. Little Axe by A People Person. Find it on, I bought it on iTunes. But I think it's on Bandcamp, Spotify. Anyways, go find it. Go buy it. Follow Sydney and all of her other projects. And I'll see you guys next week.